Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the final days of World War II in Europe. And our guest is David Stafford, author of a recently published book, Endgame 1945. The subtitle is The Missing Final Chapter of World War II. Little Brown is the publisher. In the introduction to the book, David Stafford writes this: histories of the Second World War in Europe invariably end with the surrender of German armies and the celebration of VE Day, Victory in Europe Day. That's Tuesday, May 8th, 1945. He goes on to write, from a military perspective alone, this is misleading because fighting continued in some places well past that date. Yet even where conflict ceased, Allied soldiers did not suddenly fling aside their weapons, celebrate wildly, and return home. On the contrary, for most of them, VE Day was merely a brief pause in the continuing and exhausting experience of being in uniform and under arms. As for civilians, liberation often marked the beginning and not the end of their tribulations, a bittersweet moment of exhilaration and despair. More on this in this hour as we talk with David Stafford about his book Endgame 1945, and questions from listeners are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means anywhere that you're hearing, if it would be hearing us, it would be a long-distance call. Use that number. That is 800-222-WILL, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest, David Stafford, is the author of several books on intelligence and World War II. He is a former executive director of the Canadian Institute of International Affairs and is now project director at the Center for the Study of the Two World Wars at the University of Edinburgh. Mr. Stafford, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
Pleasure.
The book, as you explain here, covers a rather brief period, at least in the history of the war, a brief period, from April 20th of 1945, which was Adolf Hitler's birthday, to July 16th of 1945, when Truman and Churchill arrived in Berlin for the Potsdam Conference. Why, I wonder, do you think that it is that this particular period has not gotten the amount of coverage that perhaps it should, and that people, as you suggest in the book, that people think, well, at VE Day, everybody went out into the street and people celebrated and there was a big party and then that was it. Well, in fact, that was not it. Why is it this period, do you think, has been overlooked?
Well, I think in a way it's precisely what you say. They focus, people have tended to focus on the military history of the war. And that war in Europe ended with the German surrender on the 8th of May, 1945. Although, as I do say, there was sporadic fighting in other parts of Europe that went on beyond that. But in essence, the military campaign was finished on the 8th of May. But, I mean, wars involve a lot more than merely military campaigns. And when a war ends, there's a hell of a mess to clear up. The soldiers remain in place. They're still under military discipline. They're, in some cases, peace has to be forcefully imposed. There is looting. There is disorder. There is chaos. Basic transport, basic services have broken down. Transport, communications. So I think we get a misleading picture of war, and I'm talking generally here, if we simply focus on military campaigns. And that's certainly true in 1945. VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, was a great moment of celebration. It was celebrated in New York, in Moscow, in Paris, in London. And it got a lot of coverage, and historians have picked up on that. And a lot of them then kind of have turned their attention from World War II to the next big conflict, which is the Cold War. So there's an interlude between the end of the fighting in World War II and the beginning of the Cold War, which I think has been pretty badly overlooked. And I wanted to at least start examining that period in a little bit more detail.
And it's certainly, I suppose, worth mentioning that even in the period that we're talking about here, there was a growing sense among the Allied leaders that this alliance was going to come apart and that they may not, I don't know what sort of language they used to describe it, but the idea that there would now be a gulf opening up and, in fact, that the Allies might indeed become enemies or rivals, that was, I'm sure, in the minds of Winston Churchill and Harry Truman and a lot of other people, and perhaps also Joseph Stalin as well.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, in a way, I mean, the way I've dealt with this subject in my book is to examine it through the experiences of nine what we might call ordinary people, individuals, civilians, and soldiers. And in more than one case where I looked at their individual stories, we can see the beginnings of the Cold War, of the wartime alliance with the Soviet Union bumping up against some pretty harsh realities, namely that the Soviets are very clearly aiming to maintain their positions in Central Europe. All the friendliness of the propaganda is not apparent in the day-to-day encounters that American and Allied soldiers have very often with Soviet authorities on the ground. They're not cooperative. And we can see here the inklings and the beginnings of the Cold War. And that certainly, as you mentioned, Churchill is picking up on that. Truman is picking up on it. And it's one reason why I wanted to take my story and end it in Berlin. I begin it in Berlin with Hitler's birthday, and I end it in Berlin on the day they arrive for the Potsdam Conference, because in a way Berlin becomes the focal point for the emerging Cold War. So there was some reason why I chose that particular date. Mm.
And I think it's noteworthy also that at that time when Churchill, Truman, and Stalin were all meeting in Berlin for the Potsdam Conference, in the United States, unknown to many, there was the test of the first atomic weapon.
That's right. The new world, the dreadful new world, nuclear age, is being born. And again, that's a date replete with significance from the viewpoint of global politics. Stalin knows about this, of course, because there are Soviet spies working in the United States. Truman and Churchill don't know that he knows, but he knows. So, yes, I mean, this is another kind of subtext to the events that are occurring in Berlin in July 1945.
At the point where you begin the story, it is essentially 3 weeks from the German surrender. Hitler is still alive. He is in Berlin. He seems determined to fight on, but one really has to wonder what he thinks is going to be the end scenario here, whether in fact that he thinks there is any possibility of a German victory. Certainly a lot of people in the German military and the high command at this point knew that they were going to lose and were already thinking about what sort of place they might be able to secure themselves in whatever scenario would follow.
That's absolutely right. Basically, Hitler's really resolving at this point on essentially a kind of nihilistic end. Rather than face defeat, have to accept surrender, he's going to go down fighting, and he's quite prepared to take Germany with him. And as many people, you know, who are going to die, they're going to die. That's just the way it is. It's a kind of nihilistic death wish, I think, at work here. But there are also dozens of other top Nazis, as well as German army people, who quite clearly can see defeat coming, and they are now looking for an exit. I mean, the most notorious case, I suppose, is Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS. You know, this dreaded figure who'd run this dreadful organization of mass murder for years under Hitler during the war, at about the time that my book opens, he's beginning to try to negotiate a surrender with the British and the Americans. He wants a way out. And, of course, for that, when Hitler discovers this, he denounces him as a traitor and so on and so forth. The regime is beginning to disintegrate here, and people are all beginning to find ways out, which is kind of ironic given that we have this notion of Nazism as being a completely fanatical regime with people who are zealously hold to their belief to the very last. Well, that's not actually what happens. Himmler is looking for a way out. Hermann Göring, who was the supposed deputy successor to Hitler, likewise, he heads south away from the advancing Russians, and he hopes to do a deal with the Americans. They're all trying to save their skin here.
It does seem remarkable that so many of these people who were in the Nazi government and the military at high levels somehow thought that that after the war ended officially, after the Germans surrendered, they seemed to think that the Allied powers would simply let them take over at whatever was left and continue on.
It is extraordinary, really. There's a kind of a willful blindness to what this Nazi regime has done that persists at high levels. I mean, Göring, I suppose, is one of the most famous examples, although how deeply he really believed he would get away with it is unsure. But certainly on the surface, he thinks he can cut a deal with the Americans, and indeed he's fostered in this belief, because when he first of all he turns himself over to the Americans, and some American generals at first treat him with kid gloves and take him out for meals, and he's photographed with them smiling and laughing, and this, I think, nurtures his belief that he might be able to cut a deal. I think the one thing that led many of them to believe this could be done was their conviction that eventually, there was going to be a war between Moscow and the West, between Stalin's Russia and the West, and that they could exploit this. They could sort of offer their services to the West, and the West would accept their services in order to fight on in a crusade against communism. And I think many of them convinced themselves that the West would be willing to do that, which, in fact, they weren't. But that's what they convinced themselves. The West is anti-communist. We're anti-communist. We're on the same side. Therefore, went the logic, and we would be welcomed with open arms. But this completely overlooked, of course, the sheer, utter, massive criminality of the regime, which had made dealing with them impossible.
Let me introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is David Stafford. He is currently project director at the Center for the Study of the Two World Wars at the University of Edinburgh. He's also former executive director of the Canadian Institute of International Affairs. He's the author of several books on intelligence and the Second World War. His most recent is Endgame 1945, The Missing Final Chapter of World War II. The book is published by Little Brown, and it looks at the period between April 20th, 1945, and July 16th, that same year, and what was going on there at around the time that fighting in Europe ended officially, but for an awful lot of people, peace at this point was quite a long way away. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. At this point, certainly the Allied commanders must have been fairly sure of victory, although perhaps they wouldn't be sure of when it would come, how much more fighting there would be. But did they think, or how much at that time were people thinking about what would happen when essentially the fighting was over, the German defeat and surrender was secured? Did they really think very much about the all of the various problems that they would face, such as how to deal with all the former German soldiers and what to do, if anything, for the non-combatants who were trying to scratch out a living in this war-devastated landscape?
Well, yes, I think, I mean, they did. They had been thinking about it. I mean, there was a plan, if you like, for what happened when the fighting stopped. They had plans for the imposition of military government, pretty detailed plans, actually, for what would happen. And for such things as denazification, they would immediately have leading Nazis removed from any positions of authority and power, demilitarization, and so on and so forth. They also were very well aware that Europe was swamped with refugees or with displaced persons. Displaced persons, this is a term that was used at the time to describe really the slave laborers that had been imported into Germany in the Third Reich by the millions in order to labor in factories. When liberation, when the Allies arrived in Germany, these people were liberated. But there it turned out there were many, many more than the Allies had anticipated. There were millions of them. And they were a major source of headache because, first of all, they clogged the roads because they just were let out of their camps. And many of them tried to get home back to the various European countries from which they'd been deported. They clogged the roads and became a real problem because as long as the fighting was continuing, they got in the way. They had to be housed. They had to be fed. Many of them were starving. They began looting on a large scale, and it was very difficult to control them. A lot of force, in the end, had to be used to control these people. I think the scale of that problem had not been anticipated. Likewise, the complete breakdown of sort of basic communications, roads, railways, and so on and so forth, was far worse than people had imagined. So while the Allies had a plan, I think that they were rather overwhelmed by the size of the plan. And this did allow for a fair amount of disorder and chaos in the initial days after the end of the war. And I do talk about that through the experiences of some of the characters in my book.
Mm-hmm. How I think it's interesting that here, particularly over the last few years, as we're trying to make sure that we hold on to as much of this history as possible and get the people who participated in it to give them a chance to talk about it in their own words, that what we're trying to do is keep, recapture, hold on to the history as seen by the people who made it on the ground level. What is it you think we have to gain by viewing these world-shaking events through the eyes of individuals that, as individuals, perhaps just participated in a small piece?
Well, very good question. History is experienced by individuals. And I think historians have a job to do which is multifaceted. One of the jobs is to understand what happened in the past by looking at the big movements and trying to understand the major forces at work. But I also think, as historians, we have a real obligation to convey to people what the actual experience of any moment in the past was like. And that is always something that's experienced by individuals. So I wanted really to convey the differential experience of the end of the war through the lives of a kind of as representative a sample as I could find of individuals. Because I also think that's how people who are not historians best understand history, really. Everyone can relate to the individual experiences of another person. And by describing that experience and by recalling it as best we can in the words of the people who experienced it, I think we bring history alive. And as a historian, I'm, of course, convinced that history is important, that we must know about it, we can learn from it, and in that sense, we must bring the past alive, and we do that in this particular way, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think that, again, getting at the notion that you have, that you suggest that probably most people have, when you have a war like this, when the official end comes, the surrender is signed, that somehow things just end, that's not the way that it is. And I think that one of the things that's really striking here is that you don't have, as people might expect, you don't have, when the war comes, the German soldiers, no matter where they are, you know, they don't just very neatly set their guns down and turn around and start walking home. That, in fact, there were places where German soldiers continued in uniform under arms even after the official end of the fighting.
That's right. You know, there was a mass. I mean, the German army in in occupied Europe was massive, consisted of millions and millions of soldiers. And when the German armies laid down their arms in May 1945, there were certain parts of Europe that the Allied armies had not yet actually reached, most notably in Holland. And large parts of Western Holland, there were no Allied troops at all, but the Germans had surrendered. So the question arose, what do we do here? So what essentially they did, there were no Allied forces to go in and disarm these troops, in other words. So in essence, what they did, they reached an agreement whereby the German army itself was responsible for keeping law and order until the Allied forces could arrive. So you do have this bizarre situation in parts of Holland where the war has ended, the fighting has stopped, but the streets are still being patrolled by German soldiers with arms, walking alongside Dutch freedom resistance fighters who are waving the Dutch flag because they've been liberated. It didn't last very long, because as soon as they could, of course, the Allies did go in and they disarmed these German troops. But it was a very bizarre situation for a long time. It was a very bizarre situation, which contrasted with what was happening elsewhere in Europe. It left a strong memory in the mind of the Dutch, mm-hmm. Who couldn't quite really understand this and had difficulty in explaining it to themselves. Yeah. So the end of the war, again, to come back to your original point, was not the same everywhere. It was variegated and it was prolonged and it lasted in this form for a longer period than elsewhere.
Yeah. And certainly the consequences of the lack of law and order would have been profound because, we might not have had law and order. We wouldn't have people who were formerly in charge. We had a lot of people who had guns. And there, everywhere there was a good deal of score settling. I'm sure that German soldiers were simply killed, that people who were considered to be collaborators and who had worked with the Germans were killed, and that perhaps just scores that didn't have anything to do with the war particularly.
There's a lot of score settling at the end of the war. I mean, my book is not, doesn't just cover Germany, it also covers Italy. And in Italy, by the end of the war, you'd had virtual civil war raging between the Italian fascists and the Italian anti-fascists. So as well as fighting the Germans, these anti-fascists were fighting fascist Italians. After the war ended and the Germans sort of left, there was a lot of settling of scores, and throughout the spring and summer and into the early autumn of 1945, reports were filtering in from Italian cities like Genoa or Milan or Turin of, you know, bodies being found on the streets in the morning when daylight came, of people who had been shot as scores were being settled. Mostly these were political scores, but not necessarily all of them. And the general disorder was an excuse for a lot of, I think, private vendettas also to be worked out.
We are on our midpoint here. Just let me again very quickly mention our guest, David Stafford. He is a project director at the Center for the Study of the Two World Wars at the University of Edinburgh and is author of a number of books dealing with intelligence and the Second World War. His most recent is Endgame 1945, The Missing Final Chapter of World War II. It's published here in the United States by Little Brown, and indeed just does deal with a period of a couple of months in 1945 that includes the official surrender of Germany and the official end of fighting in Europe. But as he has explained, and as you will see if you look at the book, peace certainly did not come at that time. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps you could talk a little bit more about how the Allies dealt with all of the German soldiers that they captured, became prisoners of war once the war officially was over.
Well, for example, one of the characters in my book is a British commando. He's in Northwest Europe. He's up in Schleswig-Holstein, which is in the extreme north of Germany on the Danish border. And he was there, and one of his jobs after the fighting stopped was to help with the surrender and marshalling of German troops. And what happened was that the Allies kind of marshalled these tens of thousands of German, corralled them, if you like, of disarmed German soldiers and marched them up into Schleswig-Holstein and kept them there until methodically and slowly they could be sent back to Germany. So they had to, you know, feed them and house them and look after them by the many millions. He experienced one slightly spine-chilling episode when he was stationed in a small town when a contingent of SS troops were marched through the town on their way to this internment camp. And he told me, because he's still alive and I talked with him, how these SS troops marched through, of course they were disarmed, but marched through the town in perfect military order, looking totally defiant, unapologetic and undefeated, and singing the Horst Wessel song, which was, if you like, the Nazi anthem. He described how this really sent chills down their spines, because quite obvious that these SS soldiers were not repentant. They did not feel defeated, although they were on their way to internment. So to come back to your original question, the Allies kept them, you know, in these huge internment camps, really. Many of them stayed on as prisoners of war for 2 or 3 years after the war.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Bloomington, Indiana, on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hi. About scores that getting settled after the war, a distinguished American I heard tell this story. He did postgraduate work in the Netherlands, and this was 10 years after the war had ended. And there was a lady with whom he struck up a conversation. He simply struck up a conversation with her. He was living in a rooming house nearby, and while he was getting groceries, this lady struck up a conversation. They talked a while, and after he'd spoken to her, he noticed everyone around him was very cool, and his landlady would hardly talk to him, and he couldn't figure out what was wrong. I bet you probably already know what was wrong, don't you?
Well, I guess he'd been a collaborator or been charged with being a collaborator.
He'd been a collaborator, and you just didn't. This was 10 years after the war was over.
Well, that's a really interesting story, and I have no doubt at all that it's absolutely true. I mean, I lived in Amsterdam for a while in the 1970s, 30 years after the war, and I had a somewhat similar experience, that there was a man on the street where I was living that was quite clearly, people thought, was not someone they wanted to talk to, and he was odd and weird. And it turned out that he had been a collaborator. This was 30 years after the war.
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Something else that the Allied forces had to think about and deal with was what they would tell their soldiers about relations with the conquered people. And initially, for example, I believe it was the United States military said to their soldiers, they told them, don't have anything at all to do with people. You know, don't talk to them. Don't even say hello, how are you, good day. Don't exchange things with them. They said, don't have anything at all to deal with. To do with the people, something that I think didn't last very long. How, though, did particularly the commanders of the Allied forces deal with this issue of the relations between the conquerors and the conquered?
Yeah. I mean, what you're talking about here is what was termed non-fraternization. And it related to Germans. It didn't relate to the countries that had been liberated, like France or Italy or Holland. That was fine. But when Allied forces entered Germany, and the enemy country, the country that was being conquered, They were issued with very, very firm instructions indeed, and these were termed really non-fraternization instructions, along the lines you'd describe. You must maintain relations with German civilians, keep them to the very, very minimum. You will probably have to deal with some of them, but you mustn't be friendly, you mustn't socialize, and so on and so forth. Non-fraternization. Now, the original justification for this was, of course, that for quite a while after the Allied forces entered Germany, they were still at war with Germany. And they were afraid that if Allied soldiers talked to German civilians, then the German civilians might pass on sensitive military information to the wrong kind of people. So originally there was a kind of military rationale for that. But it was also linked with the notion that the Germans had to be taught a lesson, that they had caused this war. They had been misled willingly by a dictator, Adolf Hitler, and that they should not be shown any friendship. This began to break down after Germany was defeated, because after all, Allied soldiers were in occupation of the country. They had to get it up and running. They needed Germans to get it up and running. And, of course, there was the problem of the women and sex, and sexual relations with German women, dating German women, and that kind of thing. You've got a large army of very young men who are healthy young men, and they want to date German women. And it was really that eventually broke the whole thing down, because non-fraternization really broke down because of that particular issue. And in the end, the Allied High Command had to admit defeat. And they did that in July 1945 and allowed American soldiers, GIs, to date German women. And that was all over then, and that was it. But it was unrealistic for a long time. It just didn't work.
And I think, too, I believe that we talked a little earlier about the fact that even at this point, the Allied commanders were thinking about what would become the Cold War, that very quickly they started thinking about the fact that they were interested in winning, so to speak, winning the hearts and minds of the German people. And also they wanted the German people to think that the Americans were nice people, where the America was a good country, because there was they foresaw this battle for allegiance, between the West and the East.
The Soviets. Yeah, that is absolutely right. I mean, along with the kind of the day-to-day challenges of enforcing non-fraternization. I mean, they had to give way on children very early on. I mean, American GIs like to sort of, say hi to kids and give them candies and so on and so forth. Strictly speaking, that was fraternization. So that was the first challenge. Then there was the challenge of relations, gender relations. And as you quite rightly say, it quickly became apparent that this was not turning the Germans into the friends that the Allies needed in the competition for the hearts and minds of Germans with the Soviet Union. And in fact, the Russians were going out of their way 2 or 3 months after the end of the fighting to be friendly with the Germans, find Germans that they could befriend and make political headway in Germany, which was beginning to come a bit of a threat. So this combination of circumstance really forces the Allies to change their tune pretty rapidly.
Let's talk with some other callers. Germantown Hills, Illinois is next. This is line number 4.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had the privilege of living in the northern part of Norway for a couple of years in the late 60s into 1970. Three brief items that tie into various points that that your guest has made. One had to do with resentments that continued long after the war. I had a Norwegian colleague who, this was in the 68 to 70, still would never set foot in a particular store in the city of Tromsø because the owners of that store had been viewed as collaborators during World War II. And so I don't know if his children and grandchildren still observe that mandate or that prohibition, but he was very bitter about those people. This is 25 years later.
Yeah.
The second story has to do with, you just mentioned the Russian troops. The Russian troops who liberated the northern part of Norway, and they did come in across the border into Finnmark, the
right.
northernmost province of Norway, and chased the German army out. The Russians set a date for their withdrawal, and they were out of Norway by that date. And during the time that they were there, they had very strict behavior codes and left behind quite a feeling of gratitude and warm feelings toward the Russians that that had some influence on Norwegian relations with Russia for decades after that. So rather than the image that we have of the Russians often being kind of crude occupiers, they were quite the contrary up there. And the third story has to do with the 25-year celebration of the German defeat, and an English colonel or general, I don't recall his rank, but came to the city of Tromsø to commemorate the takeover. The German army in the area had surrendered to him, and he came to, there were no British troops up there, but he had come to Tromsø to accept the German surrender. And there was an interesting story in the local press at the time that the British officer recounted that he came in one day, was going to have the ceremony the next morning, as I recall, and he wanted to get cleaned up for this event. And so he went to the German officer and had the barber in the German army give him a haircut and shave. And he said, I sat there in this chair. They hadn't surrendered yet. And here I am with a barber holding a razor to my neck, giving me a shave. And this was the best possible test of whether the Germans were really committed to a surrender. I just thought that was kind of an...
That's a lovely anecdote. That's a really, really wonderful anecdote. And I think that captures well the irony of, in a place like Norway, you know, where you quietly say no Allied troops had arrived, and the Germans, I mean, there was something like 200,000 or 300,000 German soldiers in Norway at the time of the surrender, and they too had to be disarmed. And so you get this very odd situation whereby essentially the Allies and the Germans have reached an agreement between them that they will bring the war to a peaceful end here. It's not going to be ended by fighting, but by agreement and gentlemen's agreements. As for your point about the Russians, that's really interesting, because I think we do have this image that the Red Army did nothing but sort of rape and loot its way across Europe in 1945. And while there was widespread looting and raping in Germany, I think it was quite within the capacity of the Red Army to enforce discipline of its soldiers if they wanted discipline to be enforced, in order to sort of befriend the local population and make political capital out of that. So that's a very interesting point, and thanks very much indeed.
Yeah. Were there places where there were significant numbers of German troops who, even after surrender, said, well, we're not going to surrender, and continued to fight?
Well, there were in parts of Germany, yes. In areas fighting the Red Army. There were one or two pockets where they continued to fight the Red Army after the surrender. Not for very long, comes back to the point I just made, that you know the Red Army had rampaged into Germany, carrying out a lot of raping and looting, making it quite clear that they were going to make the Germans suffer. So that even after the official surrender in parts of eastern Germany, they did continue fighting for a little bit longer.
Let's talk with someone else. Urbana, next caller here, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, You spoke about people shunning Nazis, ex-Nazis, after the war had ended. I know an instance where this happened in America, too, maybe 20 years after the war. In the 1960s at Johns Hopkins University, where my father taught, there was a professor, an Austrian, who had been a Nazi, and he had been in the German army stationed in the Ukraine, where the behavior of the German army was notorious. And when somebody asked him, why did Hitler try to exterminate the Jews? He said, oh, that was because they were associated with leftists. You know, got to get rid of these communists. And he married an American woman who was a school teacher and had left her job because of the desegregation in the 1950s. So he was totally, and also the only, nobody would ever invite him to any social event, never. He was never invited to dinner. He was never invited on any kind of outings. And the only person who would speak to him was a far-right wing professor of geography, I think, who had been a staunch supporter of Joe McCarthy. And, however, there was another Austrian professor there who had been in the Hitler Youth. However, people were much more complacent about him. He had a lively social life. Even married a Jewish girl, and was rather well-liked. So people certainly distinguished between them. But he was...
I think you raise a really interesting point there, which, people did distinguish between... they didn't just damn people because of their nationality. They also judged what they had done, and they judged their behavior. And one of the points I try to make in my book is that this was really an anti-Nazi war rather than an anti-German war. There were a large number of refugees from Germany and Austria who fled to places like Britain and then who joined the British armed forces and were allowed to bear arms and fought with Allied forces into Germany. Now, of course, a large number of these were Jews because they'd fled Germany because of persecution. But they were by no means all Jewish. So you do get this situation where there are Germans and Austrians fighting in the Allied armies in order to free Germany, Austria from Nazism. And I think most people understood that difference.
We just have about 5-6 minutes left, and I appreciate the comments of the caller, and I want to go and get at least one more. This is Crete, Illinois, line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, I have three questions or comments. The one, I wonder what he thought of the Ken Burns series called The War that recently appeared on public television. Two, he mentioned a few of the World War II films that he especially appreciates for authenticity and historical accuracy, Battleground, for example. And three, what the heck was Rudolf Hess doing there in Scotland? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah.
If you got the questions that the caller was...
Now, the first one was...
He was asking, here in the United States, first of all, here in the United States, in public television,
there was this big Ken Burns series
on the war.
I have to confess I haven't seen that.
Okay.
I did see the Ken Burns famous series on the Civil War, which I thought was superb, and if the series on the war is like that, I would judge it to be pretty good. But I haven't seen the Ken Burns series on war. Is that about World War II or a war in general?
No, it's about World War II.
Okay. No, I'm afraid I haven't seen it. I don't think it's shown yet in this country.
Well, and perhaps the next question the caller was just interested in, whether there are any particular films that deal with World War II that you think are good as history, that is a good reflection of what actually happened.
Well, I suppose a fair number, really. I think one of the films which I think had the greatest impact on me, I can only talk really about the impact on me, was a film called The Sorrow and the Pity. It was made a long time ago, 20, 30 years ago now, which was a study of France during the war and during the occupation. And it destroyed the myth that all French people had been in the resistance. It showed the number of people who had collaborated with the Nazis under the Vichy regime. And then there's the whole, of course, the Schoer series on the Holocaust, I'd put down pretty close to the top of my list, I think.
All right, and the other was the question about this man who was a high in the Nazi administration.
Oh,
who,
Rudolf Hess.
Rudolf Hess, who apparently tried to make his own personal deal with the Allied powers.
Yes, well, Rudolf Hess was Hitler's Nazi Party deputy, and in May 1941, he thought he might be able to negotiate a separate peace between Germany and Britain. And he was a pilot. He was a qualified pilot, and he clambered into a Messerschmitt and flew himself to Scotland in the belief that he could make contact with Winston Churchill and the lead, or at least he could make contact with people in Britain who would be prepared to sign a peace with Germany, most notably the Duke of Hamilton, who was the Scotland Premier Duke. Now, the Duke of Hamilton had no interest whatsoever in doing this. I mean, Rudolf Hess was completely wrong about this. So anyway, he arrived in Scotland. He was immediately interned and interrogated, and he was kept in prison in Britain until 1945, when he was flown out to Germany, and he was tried at Nuremberg along with all the top Nazi leaders. And very famously, he was sentenced to life imprisonment, and life imprisonment meant life imprisonment. He died in Spandau Prison in Berlin in the late 1980s. He was never let out. But that's how he came to be in Scotland. He thought he could negotiate a separate peace, but he was kind of very unrealistic. He was living in a bit of a dream world in that respect. Yeah.
There was so much more we could talk about here. We talked earlier about the kind of chaos in Germany and elsewhere that followed the war, particularly in places, I'm thinking of places that were occupied by the Germans, where there was score settling, where people were attacked because they were seen as collaborators, where German soldiers were attacked, and indeed some places, as in Italy, where you suggested what was really going on near the end of the war was there was civil war. To what extent did the Allies feel that that was something where they should or could intervene? Did they feel that it was necessary to, particularly former German soldiers, was it necessary to protect them? Or in the case of local political squabbles that ended up in shooting, did they say, well, that's none of our business, we just don't need to get involved in that?
Well, I think, again, you have to distinguish a little bit between the liberated countries and the ex-enemy countries. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the liberated countries like France, Holland, Belgium, Italy, they basically, this was really up to the local national governments, the post-war national governments, because governments in exile or new governments were very quickly formed to take over. The Allies didn't really want to get involved in the government of these liberated countries at all if they could avoid it. When it came to Germany, they imposed a pretty hard, an iron fist, if you like, when it came to Germany. The Nazis didn't all disappear. A lot of them kind of went underground. And there was a post-war, not very powerful, but nonetheless present sort of Nazi werewolf movement, as it was called. Mm-hmm. Now, the Allies imposed military government on Germany pretty strictly. And they were constantly searching out and pursuing Nazis who wanted to remain active. They brought a lot of them to trial, and a lot of them were executed into 1946, into 1947. So the Allies were very keen on keeping discipline in Germany, because they feared that once it began to break down, this might open the opportunity either to some kind of communist takeover or a resurgence of Nazism, and they didn't want either of these things to happen.
A big piece here that we haven't talked about, perhaps we can devote a minute or two to it, is the liberation of the camps. To what extent were the soldiers prepared for what they ended up seeing?
Well, I don't really think they were prepared at all, because no one was prepared. The conditions in, we're talking here about the concentration camps like Buchenwald, mm-hmm. and Dachau and Bergen-Belsen in Germany. The conditions in these camps were indescribable by the end of the war. Even people who were trained in humanitarian work were unprepared for the scale of the horrors and the disaster. I mean, people just, you know, thousands lying in bunks dying and with no food or with no medical treatment. And even after the camps were liberated, people continued to die in large numbers. They were beyond helping. And I think when Allied soldiers arrived and were the first to see the conditions in the camps, they were genuinely, genuinely shocked and horrified. And even hardened and toughened soldiers, you know, with a lot of experience, couldn't quite believe what they were seeing. And this was, I think, an important moment for the Allies. And for Allied soldiers, quite a few of them said things like, well, I hadn't really been quite sure what I was fighting for, or indeed whether I should be here fighting, whether it was worth it. But when I saw these camps, I knew what I was fighting for.
We will have to stop because we're here to the end of the time. There is more here in the book. If you're interested in reading on the final days of the European War, World War II, look for the book Endgame 1945, the missing final chapter of World War II. It's published by Little Brown by our guest David Stafford. He is project director at the Center for the Study of the Two World Wars at the University of Edinburgh. And Mr. Stafford, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.